finding it, or making it, would be a huge empirical task fraught with uncertainties and judgment calls, even if we just considered it to be a subset of the names already printed in the actual phone book as of that date, ignoring all those with unlisted numbers. Even though we can't put our hands on this volume, we can name it, just the way we named Mitochondrial Eve. Call it Megaphone. Now, we can prove things about Megaphone. For instance, the first letter printed on the first page on which there is printing is A. But the first letter on the last page on which there is printing is not A. This is not quite up to the standards of mathematical proof, of course. But what are the odds that none of the people with phones whose names begin with A is a millionaire, or that there's only one page of such millionaires in all New York? As I noted earlier, when mathematicians think about algorithms, it is usually from the God's eye perspective. They are interested in proving, for instance, that there is some algorithm with some interesting property, or that there is no such algorithm. And in order to prove such things, you needn't actually locate the algorithm you are talking about. By picking it out from a pile of algorithms stored on floppy disks, for instance. Our inability to locate the remains of Mitochondrial Eve did not prevent us from deducing facts about her, either. The empirical issue of identification thus doesn't often arise for such formal deductions. Gödel's theorem tells us that not a single one of the algorithms that can run on my Toshiba or any other computer has a certain mathematically interesting property. Being a consistent generator of proofs of arithmetic facts that generates them all if given enough runtime. That is interesting, but it doesn't help us much. Lots of interesting things can be proved, mathematically, about each and every member of various sets of algorithms. Applying that knowledge in the real world is another matter. And that is the blind spot that led Penrose to overlook AI altogether, instead of refuting it as he hoped. This has come out quite clearly in his subsequent attempts at reformulation of his claim in response to his critics. Given any particular algorithm, that algorithm cannot be the procedure whereby human mathematicians ascertain mathematical truth. Hence, humans are not using algorithms at all to ascertain truth. Penrose, 1990, page 696. Human mathematicians are not using a knowably sound algorithm in order to ascertain mathematical truth. Penrose, 1991. In the more recent of these, he goes on to consider and close various loopholes, of which two in particular concern us. Mathematicians might be using a horrendously complicated unknowable algorithm X or an unsound but presumably approximately sound algorithm Y. Penrose presents these loopholes as if they were ad hoc responses to the challenge of Gödel's theorem, instead of the standard working assumptions of AI. Of the first, he says, "This seems to be totally at variance with what mathematicians seem actually to be doing when they express their arguments in terms that can, at least in principle, be broken down into assertions that are obvious and agreed by all. I would regard it as far-fetched in the extreme to believe that it is really the horrendous, unknowable X, rather than these simple and obvious ingredients that lies lurking behind all our mathematical understanding." Penrose, 1991. These ingredients are indeed wielded by us all in an apparently non-algorithmic way. But this phenomenological fact is misleading. Penrose pays careful attention to what it is like to be a mathematician, but he overlooks a possibility, indeed a likelihood, that is familiar to AI researchers. The possibility that underlying our general capacity to deal with such ingredients is a heuristic program of mind-boggling complexity. Such a complicated algorithm would approximate the competence of the perfect understander. and be invisible to its beneficiary. Whenever we say we solved some problem by intuition, all that really means is we don't know how we solved it. The simplest way of modeling intuition in a computer is simply denying the computer program any access to its own inner workings. Whenever it solves a problem, and you ask it how it solved the problem, it should respond, "I don't know. It just came to me by intuition." Dennett, 1968. He goes on to dismiss his second loophole, the unsound algorithm, by claiming, in 1991, "Mathematicians require a degree of rigor that makes such heuristic arguments unacceptable. So, no such known procedure of this kind can be the way that mathematicians actually operate." This is a more interesting mistake, for with it, he raises the prospect that the crucial empirical test would be not to put a single mathematician in the box, but the whole mathematical community. Penrose sees the theoretical importance of the added power that human mathematicians obtain by pooling their resources, communicating with each other, and hence, becoming a sort of single giant mind that is hugely more reliable than any one homunculus we might put in the box. It is not that mathematicians have fancier brains than the rest of us, or than chimpanzees, but that they have mind tools, the social institutions in which mathematicians present each other their proofs, check each other out, make mistakes in public, and then count on the public to correct those mistakes. This does indeed give the mathematics community powers to discern mathematical truth that dwarf the powers of any individual human brain, even an individual brain with paper and pencil peripherals, a hand calculator, or a laptop. But this does not show that human minds are not algorithmic devices. On the contrary, it shows how the cranes of culture can exploit human brains in distributed algorithmic processes that have no discernible limits. Penrose doesn't quite see it that way. He goes on to say that it is our general non-algorithmic ability to understand that accounts for our mathematical abilities. And then he concludes, "It was not an algorithm X that was favored in man, at least by natural selection, but this wonderful ability to understand." Penrose, 1991. Here he commits the fallacy I just exposed using the chess example. Penrose wants to argue X can understand. There is no feasible algorithm for understanding. Therefore, what natural selection selected, the whatever it is that accounts for understanding, is not an algorithm. This conclusion is a non sequitur. If the mind is an algorithm, contrary to Penrose's claim, surely it is not an algorithm that is recognizable to or accessible to those whose minds it creates. It is, in his terms, unknowable. As a product of biological design processes, both genetic and individual, it is almost certainly one of those algorithms that are somewhere or other in the vast space of interesting algorithms, full of typographical errors or bugs, but good enough to bet your life on, so far. Penrose sees this as a far-fetched possibility. But if that is all he can say against it, he has not yet come to grips with the best version of strong AI. 3. The Phantom Quantum Gravity Computer. Lessons from Lapland. I am a strong believer in the power of natural selection, but I do not see how natural selection in itself can evolve algorithms which could have the kind of conscious judgments of the validity of other algorithms that we seem to have. Roger Penrose, 1989, page 414. I don't think the brain came in the Darwinian manner. In fact, it is disprovable. Simple mechanisms can't yield the brain. I think the basic elements of the universe are simple. Life force is a primitive element of the universe, and it obeys certain laws of action. These laws are not simple and not mechanical. Kurt Gödel. When Penrose insists that the brain is no Turing machine, it is important to understand what he is not saying. He is not making the obvious and obviously irrelevant claim that the brain is not well modeled by Turing's original thought device, a smallish gadget sitting astride a paper tape, examining one square of the tape at a time. Nobody ever thought otherwise. He is also not merely saying that the brain is not a serial computer, a von Neumann machine, but rather a massively parallel computer. And he is not just saying that the brain makes use of randomness or pseudo-randomness in running its algorithms. He sees, though some others have not, that algorithms availing themselves of large doses of randomness are still algorithms within the purview of artificial intelligence and still fall under the limitations Gödel's theorem places on all Turing machines, of whatever size and shape. Moreover, in the wake of the commentary his book provoked, Penrose now grants that heuristic programs are algorithms as well, and acknowledges that, if he is to find an argument against AI, he has to concede their tremendous power to track the truths of arithmetic and everything else, if not perfectly, then at least impressively. He offers a further point of clarification. Any computer that operates by indulging in interactions with an external environment is an algorithmic computer, provided the external environment is itself entirely algorithmic. If skyhooks grew like toadstools, or more to the point, like oracles perched on toadstools, and a computer was helped along by its occasional communication with these skyhooks, then what it did would be no algorithm. Now, with all this useful clarification in place, what does Penrose maintain? In May 1993, I spent a week with Penrose and some Swedish physicists and other scientists discussing our different views about these matters at a workshop in Abisko, a tundra research station well north of the Arctic Circle in Sweden. Perhaps the midnight sun helped as much as our Swedish hosts to illuminate the path, but in any event, I think we both came away enlightened. Penrose proposes a revolution in physics, centered on a new and still unformulated theory of quantum gravity, which he hopes will explain how the human brain transcends the limitations of algorithms. Does Penrose envisage the human brain, with its special quantum physics powers, to be a skyhook or a crane? That was the question I went to Sweden to answer, and the answer I came back with is this. He has definitely been looking for a skyhook. I think he'd settle for a new crane, but I doubt that he's found one. Descartes and Locke, and more recently Edgar Allan Poe, Kurt Gödel, and J.R. Lucas thought that the alternative to a mechanical mind would be an immaterial mind, or a soul, to speak with tradition. Hubert Dreyfus and John Searle, more recent skeptics about AI, have shunned such dualism and opined that the mind is indeed just the brain. But the brain is not any ordinary computer. It has causal powers, Searle, 1985, that go beyond the running of any algorithms. Neither Dreyfus nor Searle has been very forthcoming about what special powers these might be, or which of the physical sciences might be the right one to give an account of them. But others have wondered whether physics might hold the key. To many of them, Penrose appears to be a knight in shining armor. Quantum physics to the rescue. Several different proposals have been advanced over the years about how quantum effects might be harnessed to give the brain special powers beyond those of any ordinary computer. J.R. Lucas, 1970, yearned to drag quantum physics into this arena, but he thought that the indeterminacy gaps of quantum physics would permit a Cartesian spirit to intercede, twiddling the neurons in effect, to get some extra mind power out of the brain, a doctrine that has also been energetically defended by Sir John Eccles, the Nobel laureate neurophysiologist who has scandalized his colleagues for years with his unabashed dualism. Eccles, 1953, Popper and Eccles, 1977. This is not the time and place for me to review the reasons for dismissing this dualism. The times and places are Dennett, 1991a, 1993d. Since Penrose shuns dualism as vigorously as anybody else in the materialistic camp. What is refreshing about his attack on AI, in fact, is his insistence that he hopes to replace it with something that would still be a physical science of the mind, not some unexplorable mystery that takes place in the never-never land of dualism. Without abandoning the physical sphere, we might get some strange new powers out of subatomic particles, according to recent speculations about quantum computers. Deutsch, 1985. Such a quantum computer would take advantage, it is claimed, of the superposition of eigenstates prior to the collapse of the wave packet in order to check out vast, yes, vast with a capital V, search spaces in ordinary amounts of time. By being a sort of supermassively parallel computer, it could do vastly many things at once, and this could render feasible whole classes of algorithms that otherwise were unfeasible, such as the algorithm for perfect chess. This is not what Penrose is seeking, however, for such computers, even if they are possible, would still be Turing machines, and hence capable of computing only the officially computable functions, the algorithms. Penrose, 1989, page 402. They would hence fall under the limitations discovered by Gödel. Penrose is holding out for a phenomenon that is truly non-computable, not just impractical to compute. Present-day physics, including present-day quantum physics, is all computable, Penrose acknowledges. But he thinks that we might have to revolutionize physics, incorporating an explicitly non-computable theory of quantum gravity. Why does he think such a theory, which neither he nor anyone else has yet formulated, would have to be non-computable? Because otherwise AI is possible, and he thinks he has already shown, via his argument from Gödel's theorem, that AI is not possible. That's all. Penrose candidly admits that none of his reasons for believing in the non-computability of quantum gravity theory are drawn from quantum physics itself. The only reason he has for thinking that a theory of quantum gravity would be non-computable is that otherwise AI would be possible after all. In other words, Penrose has a hunch that someday we're going to find a skyhook. This is the hunch of a brilliant scientist. But he himself admits that it is only a hunch. In a review of the physicist Steven Weinberg's recent book, Dreams of a Final Theory, Weinberg, you will recall from Chapter 3, gave two cheers for reductionism, Penrose mused as follows. In my view, if there is to be a final theory, it could only be a scheme of a very different nature. Rather than being a physical theory in the ordinary sense, it would have to be something more like a principle, a mathematical principle, whose implementation might itself involve non-mechanical subtlety, and perhaps even creativity. Penrose, 1993, page 82. So it is not surprising that Penrose has expressed grave skepticism about Darwinism, and the grounds he gives are familiar. He can't imagine how natural selection of algorithms could do all that good work. There are serious difficulties with the picture whereby algorithms are supposed to improve themselves in this way. It would certainly not work for normal Turing machine specifications, since a mutation would almost certainly render the machine totally useless instead of altering it only slightly. Penrose, 1990, page 654. Most mutations, Penrose sees, are either invisible to selection or fatal. Only a very few improve things. That is true, but it is just as true of the evolutionary processes that produced the mandibles of crabs as it is of those that produced the mental states of mathematicians. Penrose's conviction that there are these serious difficulties is undercut, as Poe's conviction was, by the brute historical fact that genetic algorithms and their kin are daily overcoming these fearsome odds and improving themselves by, well, leaps and bounds on the geological timescale. If our brains were equipped with algorithms, Penrose argues, natural selection would have to have designed those algorithms, but the robust specifications are the ideas that underlie the algorithms. But ideas are things that, as far as we know, need conscious minds for their manifestations. Penrose, 1989, page 415. In other words, the designing process would have to appreciate somehow the rationale of those algorithms it was designing. And doesn't that take a conscious mind? Could there be reasons recognized without some conscious minds recognizing them? Yes, says Darwin, there could be. Natural selection is the blind watchmaker, the unconscious watchmaker, but still a discoverer of forced moves and other good tricks. This is not as inconceivable as many have taken it to be. To my way of thinking, there is still something mysterious about evolution, with its apparent groping towards some future purpose. Things at least seem to organize themselves somewhat better than they ought to, just on the basis of blind chance evolution and natural selection. It may well be that such appearances are quite deceptive. There seems to be something about the way that the laws of physics work, which allows natural selection to be a much more effective process than it would be with just arbitrary laws. Penrose, 1989, page 416. There could not be a clearer, more heartfelt expression of the hope for skyhooks than this, and though we cannot yet rule out in principle the existence of a quantum gravity skyhook, Penrose has not yet given us any reason to believe in one. If his theory of quantum gravity were already a reality, it could well turn out to be a crane. But he hasn't gotten that far yet, and I doubt that he ever will. At least he's trying, however. He wants his theory to provide a unified scientific picture of how the mind works, not an excuse for declaring the mind to be an impenetrable ultimate source of meaning. My own opinion is that the path he is now exploring, in particular, the possible quantum effects occurring in the microtubules of the cytoskeleton of neurons, an idea enthusiastically promoted in Abisko by Stuart Hameroff, is a non-starter. But that is not a topic for this occasion. I can't resist raising one question for Penrose to ponder. If the magnificent quantum property lurks in the microtubules, does that mean that cockroaches have non-computable minds too? They have the same kind of microtubules we have. If a Penrose-style quantum gravity brain were truly capable of non-algorithmic activity, and if we have such brains, and if our brains are themselves the products of an algorithmic evolutionary process, a curious inconsistency emerges. An algorithmic process, natural selection in its various levels and incarnations, creates a non-algorithmic sub-process or subroutine, turning the whole process, evolution up to and including human mathematician brains, into a non-algorithmic process after all. This would be a cascade of cranes creating eventually a real skyhook. No wonder Penrose has his doubts about the algorithmic nature of natural selection. If it were truly just an algorithmic process at all levels, all its products should be algorithmic as well. So far as I can see, this isn't an inescapable formal contradiction. Penrose could just shrug and propose that the universe contains these basic nuggets of non-algorithmic power. not themselves created by natural selection in any of its guises, but incorporatable by algorithmic devices as found objects whenever they are encountered, like the oracles on the toadstools. Those would be truly non-reducible skyhooks. The position is, I guess, possible, but Penrose must face an embarrassing shortage of evidence for it. The physicist, Hans Hansen, came up with a good challenge in Abisko, comparing a perpetual motion machine to a truth-detecting computer. Different sciences, Hansen noted, can offer different reliable shortcuts to verdicts about projects. If someone were to go to the Swedish government with a plan to build a perpetual motion machine at government expense, Hansen would unhesitating testify as a physicist that this would have to be, a waste of government money. It could not succeed, because physics has proven that a perpetual machine is flat impossible. Did Penrose think that he had offered a similar sort of proof? If some AI entrepreneur were to go to the government asking for money to build a mathematical truth-detecting machine, would Penrose be similarly willing to testify that such money would be wasted? To make the question more specific, consider some rather special varieties of mathematical truth. It is well known that there can be no all-purpose program that can examine any other program and tell whether or not it has an infinite loop in it, and hence will not stop if started. This is known as the halting problem, and there is a Gödel-style proof that it is insoluble. This is one of the theorems Turing alluded to in his 1946 comment, quoted at the beginning of the chapter. No program that is itself guaranteed to terminate can tell of every finite program whether or not it will terminate. But it might still be handy, worth some serious money, to have a program around that was very, very good, if not perfect, at this task. Another class of interesting problems are known as Diophantine equations, and it is known that there is no algorithm guaranteed to solve all such equations. If our lives depended on it, should we spend a nickel on a program for solving Diophantine equations in general, or for checking for halting in general? Remember, we shouldn't spend a nickel on perpetual motion machines, even to save our lives, since it will be money wasted on an impossible task. Penrose's answer was illuminating. If the candidates for truth-checking just somehow bubble up out of the ground, then we would be wise to spend the money. But if some intelligent agent is the source of the candidates and gets to examine the program in our truth-checker, then it can foil our algorithmic truth-checker by constructing just the wrong candidate or candidates, an equation unsolvable by it, or a program whose termination prospects will confound it. To make the distinction vivid, we can imagine that a space pirate, Rumpelstiltskin by name, is holding the planet hostage, but will release us unharmed if we can answer 1,000 true-false questions about sentences of arithmetic. Should we put a human mathematician on the witness stand, or a computer truth-checker devised by the best programmers? According to Penrose, if we hang our fate on the computer and let Rumpelstiltskin see the computer's program, he can devise an Achilles heel proposition that will foil our machine. This would be true independently of Gödel's theorem if our program was a heuristic truth checker, taking risks like any chess program. But Penrose has given us no reason to believe that this isn't just as true of any human mathematicians we might put on the witness stand. None of us is perfect, and even a team of experts no doubt has some weaknesses that Rumpelstiltskin could exploit, given enough information about their brains. Von Neumann and Morgenstern invented game theory to deal with a particular class of complicated problems that life throws at us when there are other agents around to compete with us. You are always wise to shield your brain from such competitors, whether you are a human being or a computer. The reason a competitive agent makes a difference in this instance is that the space of all mathematical truths is vast. The space of Diophantine equation solutions is a vast but vanishing subspace within it. And the odds of hitting upon a truth at random that would break or beat our machine is truly negligible, whereas an intelligent search through that space, guided by knowledge of the particular style of the opponent and its limitations, would be likely to find the needle in the haystack, a crushing countermove. Rolf Wason raised another interesting point in Abisko. The class of interesting algorithms no doubt includes many that are not humanly accessible. To put it dramatically, there are programs out there in the library of Toshiba that would not just run on my Toshiba, but be valued by me for the wonderful work they would do for me, but that no human programmers or any of their artifacts, program writing programs already exist, will ever be able to create. How can this be? None of these wonderful programs is more than a megabyte long, and there are plenty of actual programs much bigger than that already. Once again, we must remind ourselves just how vast the space of such possible programs is. Like the space of possible 500-page novels, or 50-minute symphonies, or 5,000-line poems, the space of megabyte-long programs will only ever get occupied by the slenderest threads of actuality, no matter how hard we work. There are short novels nobody could write that would not just be bestsellers. They would be instantly recognized as classics. The keystrokes required to type them are all available on any word processor, and the total number of keystrokes in any such book is trivial, but they still lie beyond the horizon of human creativity. Each particular creator, each novelist or composer or computer programmer, is sped along through design space by a particular idiosyncratic set of habits known as a style. Hofstadter, 1985, Section 3. It is style that both constrains and enables us, giving a positive direction to our explorations, but only by rendering otherwise neighboring regions off limits to us. And if off limits to us in particular, then probably off limits to everyone forever. Individual styles are truly unique, the product of untold billions of serendipitous encounters over the ages. Encounters that produced first a unique genome, and then a unique upbringing, and finally a unique set of life experiences. Proust never got a chance to write any novels about the Vietnam War, and no one else could ever write them, the novels recounting that epoch in his manner. We are stuck by our actuality and finitude in a negligible corner of the total space of possibilities. But what a fine actuality is still accessible to us thanks to the R&D work of all our predecessors. We might as well make the most of what we have, thereby leaving rather more for our descendants to work with. It is time to turn the burden of proof around, the way Darwin did when he challenged his critics to describe some other way, other than natural selection, in which all the wonders of nature could have arisen. Those who think the human mind is non-algorithmic should consider the hubris presupposed by that conviction. If Darwin's dangerous idea is right, an algorithmic process is powerful enough to design a nightingale and a tree. Should it be that much harder for an algorithmic process to write an ode to a nightingale or a poem as lovely as a tree? Surely Orgel's second rule is correct. Evolution is cleverer than you are. Chapter 15. Gödel's theorem does not cast doubt on the possibility of AI after all. In fact, once we appreciate how an algorithmic process can escape the clutches of Gödel's theorem, we see more clearly than ever how design space is unified by Darwin's dangerous idea. Chapter 16. What then about morality? Did morality evolve too? Sociobiologists, from Thomas Hobbes to the present, have offered just-so stories about the evolution of morality, but, according to some philosophers, any such attempt commits the naturalistic fallacy, the mistake of looking to facts about the way the world is in order to ground or reduce ethical conclusions about how things ought to be. This fallacy is better seen as a charge of greedy reductionism, a charge which is often justified. But then we shall just have to be less greedy in our reductionism. Chapter 16. On the Origin of Morality. 1. E pluribus unum? Nature, the art whereby God hath made and governs the world, is, by the art of man, as in many other things, so in this also imitated, that it can make an artificial animal. For seeing life is but a motion of limbs, the beginning whereof is in some principal part within, why may we not say that all automata, engines that move themselves by springs and wheels as doth a watch, have an artificial life? For what is the heart but a spring, and the nerves but so many strings, and the joints but so many wheels giving motion to the whole body, such as was intended by the artificer? Art goes yet further, imitating that rational and most excellent work of nature, man. For by art is created that great leviathan called a commonwealth or state, in Latin civitas, which is but an artificial man, though of greater structure and strength than the natural, for whose protection and defense it was intended, and in which the sovereignty is an artificial soul, as giving life and motion to the whole body. Thomas Hobbes, 1651, page 1. Thomas Hobbes was the first sociobiologist, 200 years before Darwin. As the opening words of his masterpiece make clear, he saw the creation of the state as fundamentally a matter of one's artifacts making another, a sort of group survival vehicle, intended for the protection and defense of its occupants. The frontispiece of the original edition shows how seriously he took his own metaphor. Why, though, do I call Hobbes a sociobiologist? He couldn't have wanted to exploit Darwin's ideas in an analysis of society, like today's sociobiologists. But he did see, clearly and confidently, the fundamental Darwinian task. He saw that there had to be a story to be told about how the first state came to be created, and how it brought with it something altogether new on the face of the earth: morality. It would be a story taking us from a time in which there clearly was no right and wrong, just amoral competition, to a time in which there manifestly was right and wrong, in some parts of the biosphere, via a process that gradually introduced the essential features of an ethical perspective. Since the relevant period was prehistoric, and since he had no fossil record to consult, his story would have to be a rational reconstruction, a just-so story of sorts, to commit a further anachronism. Once upon a time, he said, there was no morality at all. There was life. There were human beings. And they even had language, so they had memes, to commit a third anachronism. We can presume that they had words, and hence memes, for good and bad, but not ethical good and bad. The notions of right and wrong, justice and injustice, have there no place. So, although they distinguished a good spear from a bad spear, a good supper from a bad supper, a good hunter, an expert killer of supper, from a bad hunter who scared away the prey, they had no concept of a good or just person, a moral person, or a good act, a moral act, or their contraries, villains and vices. They could appreciate that some people were more dangerous than others, or better fighters, or more desirable mates. But their perspective went no farther than that. They had no concept of right or wrong because they are qualities that relate to men in society, not in solitude. Hobbes called this epoch in our prehistory the state of nature, because it resembled in its most important features the plight of all the other animals in the wild to this day. In the state of nature, there is no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And then, one fine day, a mutation happened to arise. One day, when yet another conflict arose, just like all the others that had come before it, something new happened to happen. Instead of persisting in the myopically selfish policies of mutual defection and distrust that had reigned heretofore, these particular lucky competitors hit upon a new idea: cooperation for mutual benefit. They formed a social contract. Whereas before there had been families or herds or tribes, this was the birth of a different kind of group, a society. This was the birth of civilization. And the rest, as one says, is history. How Hobbes would have admired Lynn Margulis's story of eukaryotic revolution and the creation thereby of multicellular life. Whereas before there had been nothing but boring prokaryotes drifting through their nasty, brutish, short lives, now there could be multicellular organisms which, thanks to a division of labor among a gang of specialist cells, could engage in industry, oxygen-fired metabolism in particular, and arts, long-range perception and locomotion, and protective coloration, and so forth. And in due course, their descendants created multicellular societies of a very peculiar sort, known, until recently, as men, capable of creating letters or representations, which they fell to exchanging promiscuously. This made possible a second revolution. How Hobbes would have admired Richard Dawkins's story of the birth of memes and the creation thereby of persons who were not mere survival vehicles for their genes. These tales, composed long after his, narrate major steps in evolution that antedate the step he decided to describe, the step from persons without morality to citizens. He saw this, correctly, as a major step in the history of life on this planet, and he set out to tell the tale as best he could of the conditions under which this step could be taken and, once taken, evolutionarily enforced, to use one more anachronism. Though it was not a saltation but a small step, it had momentous consequences, for it was the birth of a hopeful monster indeed. It would be a mistake to read Hobbes as a would-be historian who was simply speculating irresponsibly. He surely knew that there was no hope of finding the birthplace of civilization with the tools of history, or archaeology, a discipline not yet invented, but that was not his point. No doubt the actual prehistoric sequence of events was more muddled and distributed with elements of quasi-society, of the sort we see among herds of ungulates and packs of predators, quasi-language, of the sort we see among alarm-calling birds and monkeys, and even among foraging bees, and perhaps even elements of quasi-morality, of the sort reputedly evidenced by monkeys, as well as solicitous whales and dolphins. Hobbes's rational reconstruction was a huge oversimplification, a model intended to illustrate the essentials while ignoring the grubby and unknowable details. And without any doubt, it was too simple even in its own terms. Today, in the wake of hundreds of investigations into the nooks and crannies of game theory, prisoner's dilemma tournaments and the like, we know that Hobbes was altogether too sanguine, to use a word from his vocabulary, about the conditions under which a social contract would be evolutionarily enforceable. But he was the pioneer explorer of this phenomenon. Following in his footsteps, Jean-Jacques Rousseau and various English thinkers, including John Locke, offered their own rational reconstructions of the birth of society. More intricate, contractarian, just-so stories have been exploited in recent years. The most famous and most sophisticated is John Rawls's Theory of Justice, 1971, but there are others. They all agree in seeing morality to be, in one way or another, an emergent product of a major innovation in perspective that has been achieved by just one species, Homo sapiens, taking advantage of its unique extra medium of information transfer, language. In Rawls's thought experiment about how a society ought to be formed, we are to imagine a time, at the birth of society, when its inhabitants gather to consider what sort of design their society shall have. They are to reason together about this until they achieve what Rawls calls reflective equilibrium, a stable agreement that cannot be upset by further consideration. In this regard, Rawls's idea is like Maynard Smith's idea of an evolutionary stable strategy, or ESS, but with a major difference. These are people doing the calculation, not birds or pine trees or other simple competitors in the games of life. The key innovation in Rawls's scenario, designed to ensure that undue selfishness among the participants in this exercise in reflection cancels itself out, is what he calls the veil of ignorance. Everyone gets to vote on a favored design of society. But when you decide which society you would be happy to live in and give your allegiance to, you vote without knowing what your particular role or niche in it will be. You may be a senator or a surgeon or a street sweeper or a soldier. You don't get to find out until after you have voted. Choosing from behind the veil of ignorance ensures that people will give due consideration to the likely effects, the costs and benefits for all the citizenry, including those worst off. Rawls's theory has received and deserved more attention than any other work in ethics in this century. And as usual, I am presenting an oversimplified version of the issues. My point is to draw attention to the placement of this work, and all the work that it has provoked and inspired, relative to Darwinian thinking in general, and evolutionary ethics in particular. Note especially that, whereas Hobbes presented a rational reconstruction of something that actually happened, something that must have happened, Rawls presents a thought experiment about what, if it did happen, would be right. Rawls's project is not speculative history or prehistory, but an entirely normative project, an attempt to demonstrate how ethical questions ought to be answered, and, more particularly, an attempt to justify a set of ethical norms. Hobbes hoped to solve the normative problem about what ethics ought to be, Rawls's problem. But greedy reductionist that he was, he tried to kill two birds with one stone. He also wanted to explain how such a thing as right and wrong came into existence in the first place, an exercise of imagination in the Darwinian mode. Needless to say, life is more complicated than that. But it was a nice try. Hobbes's account in The Leviathan has a fine Panglossian ring to it, in both accepted senses of that popular word. First, by presupposing the rationality, or prudence, as he called it, of the agents whose mutual solution society is supposed to be, he viewed the birth of society as dictated by reason, a forced move, or at least strongly endorsed by reason, a good trick. In other words, Hobbes's tale is an adaptationist just-so story, and none the worse for it. But second, By appealing as it does to our sense of the good of our own species, it is apt to lull us into overly sanguine models of how it must have come about. And this is a serious criticism. It may occur to us that, however it came about, the birth of morality was a good thing for us, but we should try not to indulge in that sort of reflection. No matter how true it may be, it cannot explain how these practices, for which we are retrospectively so grateful, came into existence and persisted. Group rationality may not be assumed, any more than we may assume that since we have benefited mightily from the eukaryotic revolution, it is thereby explained. Group rationality or cooperation has to be achieved, and that is a major design task, whether we are considering alliances of prokaryotes or alliances of our more recent ancestors. In fact, much of the best work in ethics in recent years has concerned precisely this issue. For example, Parfit, 1984, Gautier, 1986, Gibbard, 1985. Before looking more closely at the human predicament in this regard, we might consider more cautiously the metaphor that Hobbes invites us to take seriously, helping ourselves to the improved perspective provided by the Darwinian revolution that has intervened. In what regards is a society like a giant organism, and in what regards is it different? Multicellular organisms have solved the problem of group solidarity. One never hears tales of a person's thumbs rising up in civil war against the neighboring fingers, or of an eagle's wings going on strike, refusing to work unless some concession can be wrung from the beak, or, more to the point, the gonads. And now that we have the gene's eye perspective from which to look at the world, this can strike us as something of a puzzle. Why don't these rebellions happen? Each cell in a multicellular organism has its own strings of DNA, a complete set of genes for making a whole organism. And if genes are selfish, why do the genes in the thumb cells or wing cells so docilely cooperate with the rest of the genes? Don't the DNA copies in the thumb and wings count as genes? Are they denied the vote? Why do they put up with it? As the biologist David Sloan Wilson and the philosopher of biology Elliot Sober, Wilson and Sober, 1994, have suggested, we can learn a lot about our social problems of defection, for example, promising and then reneging on the promise, and Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons, listen to Chapter 9, by considering how our ancestors, going back to the first eukaryotes, managed to achieve harmony and coordination of their parts. The lessons to be learned are tricky, however, because the cells that compose us belong to two very different categories. An average human is normally host to billions of symbiotic organisms belonging to perhaps 1,000 different species. His phenotype is not determined by his human genes alone, but also by the genes of all the symbionts he happens to be infected with. The symbiont species an individual carries usually have a very varied provenance, with only a few being likely to have come from his parents. Delius, 1991, page 85. Am I an organism, or a community, or both? I am both, and more. But there is a tremendous difference between the cells that are officially part of my body and the cells, many of them just as important to my survival, that are not. The cells that compose multicellular me all share an ancestry. They are a single lineage, the daughter cells and granddaughter cells of the egg and sperm that united to form my zygote. They are host cells. The other cells are visitors. Some welcome, some not. The visitors are outsiders, because they have descended from different lineages. What difference does this make? This is extremely easy to lose sight of, especially in contexts in which we treat all these parties as intentional systems, as we should, but with extreme caution. Unless we are careful, we are apt to miss the fact that there are crucial moments in the careers of these various agents and semi-agents and hemi-semi-demi-agents when opportunities to decide arise and then pass. The cells that compose my bulk have a shared fate, but some in a stronger sense than others. The DNA in my finger cells and blood cells is in a genetic cul-de-sac. In Weissman's terms, listen to chapter 11, these cells are part of the somatic line, the body, not the germ line, the sex cells. Barring revolutions in cloning techniques and ignoring the strictly limited short-lived prospects they have for giving way to replacement cells they help create, my somatic line cells are doomed to die childless. And since this was determined some time ago, there is no longer any pressure, any normal opportunity, any choice points at which their intentional trajectories or the trajectories of their limited progeny might be adjusted. They are, you might say, ballistic intentional systems, whose highest goals and purposes have been fixed once and for all, with no chance of reconsideration or guidance. They are totally committed slaves to the summum bonum of the body of which they form a part. They may be exploited or tricked by visitors, but under normal circumstances they cannot rebel on their own. Like the Stepford wives, they have a single summum bonum designed right into them, and it is not look out for number one. On the contrary, they are team players by their very nature. How they further this summum bonum is also designed right into them. And in this regard, they differ fundamentally from the other cells that are in the same boat, my symbiont visitors. The benign mutualists, the neutral commensals, the deleterious parasites that share the vehicle they all together compose, namely me, each have their own summum bonum designed into them. And it is to further their own respective lineages. Fortunately, there are conditions under which an entente cordiale can be maintained, for after all, they are all in the same boat, and the conditions under which they can do better by not cooperating are limited. But they do have the choice. It is an issue for them in a way it is not for the host cells. Why? What enables or requires the host cells to be so committed, but gives the visitor cells a free rein to rebel when the opportunity arises? Neither sort of cell is a thinking, perceiving, rational agent, of course, and neither sort is significantly more cognitive than the other. That is not where the fulcrum of evolutionary game theory is located. Redwood trees are not notably clever either, but they are in conditions of competition that force them to defect, creating what is, from their point of view, a wasteful tragedy. The mutual cooperative agreement whereby they would all forego growing tall trunks and abandon their vain attempts to gain more than their fair share of sunlight is evolutionarily unenforceable. The condition that creates a choice is the mindless voting of differential reproduction. It is the opportunity for differential reproduction that lets the lineages of our visitors change their minds or reconsider the choices they have made by exploring alternative policies. My host cells, however, have been designed once and for all by a single vote at the time my zygote was formed. If, thanks to mutation, dominating or selfish strategies occur to them, they will not flourish relative to their contemporaries, since there is scant opportunity for differential reproduction. Cancer can be seen as a selfish and vehicle-destructive rebellion made possible by a revision that does permit differential reproduction. The philosopher and logician Brian Skirms has recently pointed out 1993, 1994A, 1994B, that the precondition for normal cooperation in the strongly shared fate of somatic line cells is analogous to the cooperation Rawls tried to engineer behind the veil of ignorance. He calls this, aptly, the Darwinian veil of ignorance. Your sex cells, sperm or ova, are formed by a process unlike that of normal cell division or mitosis. Your sex cells are formed by a different process called meiosis, which randomly constructs half a genome candidate to join forces with a half from your mate by choosing first a bit from column A, the genes you got from your mother, and then a bit from column B, the genes you got from your father, until a full complement of genes, but just one copy of each, is constructed and installed in a sex cell, ready to try its fate in the great mating lottery. But which daughters of your original zygote are designed for meiosis and which for mitosis? This, too, is a lottery. Thanks to this mindless mechanism, paternal and maternal genes in you could not ordinarily know their fate in advance. The question of whether they are going to have germline progeny that might have a flood of descendants flowing on into the future, or be relegated to the sterile backwaters of somatic line slavery for the good of the body politic or cooperation, think of the etymology, is unknown and unknowable. So there is nothing to be gained by selfish competition among their fellow genes. That, at any rate, is the usual arrangement. There are special occasions, however, on which the Darwinian veil of ignorance is briefly lifted. We have already noted them. They are the cases of meiotic drive or genomic imprinting. Haig and Graffin, 1991. Haig, 1992. We considered in Chapter 9 in which circumstances do permit a selfish competition between genes to arise. And arise it does, leading to escalating arms races. But under most circumstances, the time to be selfish for genes is strictly limited. And once the die, or the ballot, is cast, those genes are just along for the ride until the next election. Skirms shows that when the individual elements of a group, whether of whole organisms or their parts, are closely related, clones or near clones, or are otherwise able to engage in mutual recognition and assortative mating, the simple game theory model of the prisoner's dilemma, in which the strategy of defecting always dominates, does not correctly model the circumstances. That is why our somatic cells don't defect. They are clones. This is one of the conditions under which groups, such as the group of my host cells, can have the harmony and coordination required to behave, quite stably, as an organism or individual. But before we give three cheers and take this to be our model for how to make a just society, we should pause to notice that there is another way of looking at these model citizens, the somatic line cells and organs. Their particular brand of selflessness is the unquestioning obedience of zealots or zombies, exhibiting a fiercely xenophobic group loyalty that is hardly an ideal for human emulation. We, unlike the cells that compose us, are not on ballistic trajectories. We are guided missiles, capable of altering course at any point, abandoning goals, switching allegiances, forming cabals and then betraying them, and so forth. For us, it is always decision time. And because we live in a world of memes, no consideration is alien to us or a foregone conclusion. For this reason, we are constantly faced with social opportunities and dilemmas of the sort for which game theory provides the playing field and the rules of engagement, but not the solutions. Any theory of the birth of ethics is going to have to integrate culture with biology. As I have said before, life, for people in society, is more complicated. 2. Friedrich Nietzsche's Just-So Stories. The first impulse to publish something of my hypotheses concerning the origin of morality was given me by a clear, tidy, and shrewd also precocious little book in which I encountered distinctly for the first time an upside-down and perverse species of genealogical hypothesis, the genuinely English type that attracted me, with that power of attraction which everything contrary, everything antipodal possesses. Friedrich Nietzsche, 1887, Preface. It is in perfect accordance with the scheme of nature, as worked out by natural selection, that matter excreted to free the system from superfluous or injurious substances should be utilized for other highly useful purposes. Charles Darwin, 1862, page 266. Friedrich Nietzsche published his Genealogy of Morals in 1887. He was the second great sociobiologist, and unlike Hobbes, he was inspired or provoked by Darwinism. As I noted in Chapter 7, Nietzsche probably never read Darwin. His contempt for the English type of genealogy was directed against the social Darwinists, Herbert Spencer in particular, and Darwin's fans on the continent. One fan was Nietzsche's friend, Paul Ree, whose tidy book, Origin of the Moral Sensations, 1877, provoked Nietzsche's untidy masterpiece. The social Darwinists were sociobiologists, but certainly not great ones. In fact, their efforts almost did in the memes of their hero by popularizing second-rate perversions of them. The survival of the fittest, Spencer proclaimed, is not just Mother Nature's way, but ought to be our way. According to the social Darwinists, it is natural for the strong to vanquish the weak, and for the rich to exploit the poor. This is simply bad thinking, and Hobbes has already shown us why. It is equally natural to die young and illiterate, without benefit of eyeglasses for myopia or medicine for illness, for that is how it was in the state of nature. But surely this counts for nothing when we ask, ought it then be that way now? Alternatively, since it was, in an extended sense, entirely natural, it wasn't supernatural, for us to step out of the state of nature and adopt a host of societal practices for our mutual benefit, we may simply deny that there is anything universally natural about the strong dominating the weak, and the rest of the social Darwinist nonsense. It is amusing to note that the fundamental bad argument of the social Darwinists